Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Reptile Radio fans, and welcome to the show that's like a big bag of Halloween ear candy for your herp head every time you listen. It's Sunday, July 12th, 2015, and I'm totally stoked to bring you this show to my favorite Double R faithful. All of our American listeners out there, I hope you guys had a happy and safe 4th, and that all of our international listeners, excuse my tendency to use a U.S. calendar as my point of seasonal reference so much. I do realize it's winter in the Southern Hemisphere, and I do realize this is an international show, and I do want everyone out there to know that I don't intend to offend if I do something like congratulate the U.S. Women's FIFA Cup champs on the air. Nice work, ladies. Speaking of herps and ladies, I'd like to shout out a little lady listener and future herper extraordinaire Kenzie Yates, as her parents are working hard setting up her birthday celebration today. Happy birthday, Mackenzie. God bless. And I hope you have lots of fun on your special day. One more shout out before we get on the on with today's show. I'd just like to acknowledge Jason Brumley of the BLBC Boards for working hard, getting noticed, and being promoted to the Officers Club of the best herb boards on the internet. Nice work, Brumley, and thanks for helping to make the BLBC the very best herb place to be. Today's guest is a fella I happen to know personally from prior escapades at Tinley Park, where Stephen has been known to show up with his lovely lady Jacqueline ever present by his side. Mr. Stephen Tillis may still be young by chronological standards, but his education and experiences lend a sage-like quality to his half of every conversation I've ever had with him. I'm truly excited to bring someone like Steve out into the Reptile Nation light a little bit more by having him on today, and I personally feel he's a great ambassador for our hobby. So please help me welcome, fresh from his recent trip to Togo, Africa, and hailing from the great herp state of Florida, Mr. Stephen Reptilis. Welcome aboard, Steve. Great to have you on the Double R Waves.
Hey, CK. Thanks for having me.
Hey, man. It's a pleasure to have you. How's it going?
Doing well. Another hot day here in Florida.
Ooh, what are we tapping out today?
I think it's been breaking 100 lately, actually. It's been really hot.
Oh, that's like sewage, man. That is so foul.
Yeah.
It's in the high 80s. Yeah, it's in the high 80s in New York today, so I'm feeling it a little bit too, but got the air on, sitting inside, doing a show with you, and I'm stoked to get this rocking and rolling, man. Now, as a Reptile Radio faithful yourself, you know, you got to give us your How I Get Started story. So please, let's have it and make it good. Juicy details, the whole nine yards. Let it rip, man.
So, you know, I my grandfather managed a conservation center down in South Florida when my dad was growing up. So wildlife has always kind of been, you know, sort of a center point in the family. So when I was growing up, he would, you know, take me around and we'd find little, like, corn snakes and stuff. And so I remember one time we found this corn snake coiled up in this garden hose. And so I, you know, he taught me how to pick it up and how to hold it without getting bit. And so we stuck it in this pretzel jar, like a giant pretzel jar, and kept it for a couple of days. And, you know, he showed me how to feed it a lizard and, so I watched it eat, and then so, you know, it was a couple of days later, we were going to release it, and I wanted to show off how much I knew. So I reached into this pretzel jar to take the snake out, and I remember the thing just latching onto my finger, and instead of, you know, freaking out, it just flipped some switch in my brain, and ever since then, you know, it's been a constant obsession with snakes. So really, that's the one memory I have that is the most, you know, it stands out for what really got me into reptiles. And then, you know, since then I basically grew up on the Bush League Breeders Club. I think I was 13 or 14 when I signed up. And so, you know, it's sort of interesting because you can watch, you know, some of my old posts build from, you know, a small-time teenage hobbyist to, you know, where I'm at today, which is, you know, close to full-time business of breeding and selling snakes. So,
That's cool, man. That's like that truly is a love at first bite story, man. I like that. That's, you know what, most people, they share like a really fun, pleasant experience. But I mean, you were having fun and it didn't freak you out. But it's cool that you got bit.
Yeah,
not at all.
Yeah,
you got bit harder. You know, harder than that little corn snake bite. That's for sure. That's awesome, man. Well, that's a cool story. Now, you're currently close to doing this as a full time gig, from the sound of it.
Yeah, it's getting there. As much as I can afford time for it, you know, I try to work for it. But I'm also a full-time student at the University of Florida here in Gainesville. And then I also work for Eugene Bissette part-time. So I manage a lot of his breeding colonies and stuff like that, and manage more of the genetics behind everything. So I'm stretched a little thin, but, you know, as much time as I can devote to it, I do. So
That's awesome, man. Now, you know, you've also I checked your website, and you got a really cool website. What's the website called again, the website?
So I kind of have two. The main website that I use for selling stuff is reptilisherbs.com, but then I also have another website, which is redbloodpython.com, which is pretty much strictly devoted to, you know, care information and morph lists and stuff. I wanted to kind of make sort of like a world of ball pythons for blood pythons, but, you know, a little bit different. So that was sort of the purpose behind that website.
Oh, so that's cool. So you really you're out there in the public eye a lot, man. It's a lot more than most people know. I mean, I know you've done a couple of radio shows in the past, and I didn't have time after speaking to you to actually get a chance to listen to them, but I think that's good, because I think people like you need to be out there. People who need to be in the light, because honestly, man, you're a good example of what, you know, what conservation minded herp breeders are all about. You're very adept, you're smart, you got a lot going on, and I want people like you to be the poster children for this, you know, crazy freaking hobby that we're into. It's cool.
Thank you.
No problem, man. And the fact that you're into bloods is great, cuz, you know, bloods aren't like everybody's pet of choice, but they are a great snake to keep, man. And, you know, I've had them too. I really love them too. And I think that's a great, like, in-between size, before you get into giant snakes, you know. So good stuff with that.
And the interest in bloods is definitely growing. You know, it's getting pretty big. There's a lot of stuff out there, a lot of cool animals. And, you know, they're probably my favorite python to work with, so.
Cool. Well, I can't say I blame you, man. I definitely enjoyed that myself. Now, recently, you just come back from a trip to Togo, Africa, and that was kind of like the impetus for getting you on the show. I mean, there are so many people out there. I don't believe I sent you the show description, so you didn't read it, but there's so many people out there that, like, dream about being in the, you know, being in the wild with the, like, in the actual environment where their animals are from, just to, like, feel it, understand it better, know it. And I'm sure that was probably part of the impetus that sent you there in the first place. And I'm kind of wondering if you could share that whole story with us, man. That would be great, because I'm sure that it's a burning question in a lot of people's heads what it's really like. And I know Stefan Broghammer has a couple of videos out and stuff, but, man, I want to hear it from an American kid from Florida. You know, I want to hear it from your angle and you know, what you take away from it. Now, you go to school for ecology?
Wildlife ecology and conservation, which you basically get a group basically divided in two, where you get all of the hippie, want to save every little animal, people, and then the rest of the people are like hardcore hunters. So you get like this way divided spectrum between like hippies and hunters. So it's sort of a weird dynamic. And I feel like I sometimes walk the line between the two. So it's interesting background to view going to a place like Togo in.
Oh, okay, man. Yeah, I can imagine that. That's really a good angle to approach it from, too, because if you really are on the fence in the dichotomy section over there, I like that there's going to be some good perspective coming from you from both sides. So now I'm thinking we got a little background. You definitely are qualified to talk about these points from an education standpoint, which I like also, and you are passionate about that, and we did have a pre-show phone call that indicated to me that this is definitely something you're into, and I love to hear that kind of angle come out of somebody who's passionate. So we got your background, like, inside and outside the hobby. Like, what what are you bringing to the table besides, all right, you know, you told us you worked for Eugene. Didn't you work somewhere else that was a big herp place too down there?
I did a little bit of venomous training at Glades Herp a couple years ago, just doing venomous permit stuff. But I've been working for Eugene now for the past three years now, I think.
Okay, that's a good amount of time. And Mr. Bissett's been a guest on the show, as you know. And Eugene is a font of information, so I'm sure you're tapping his brain all day long.
Yeah, we have a good dynamic between the two of us, definitely.
That's great. You know, he's a great guy, and you're a good guy too, from what I know of you. And I'm sure that the dynamic there's got to be working out really nice. Now, so you said you handle his breeding, like you, I guess BP stuff or all this, because he works with more species than just BPs.
Yeah, I mean it's. We have a pretty good mix going, and you know, my role has been sort of like a genetics liaison kind of thing, you know, just sort of managing the genetics behind the colony, making sure we're kind of steering the ship in the right direction, I guess. You know, with the market the way it is, it can definitely be, you know, you need to choose your projects well, so.
Okay, that's, and you know what, here's what I take away from what you just said. For someone like Eugene, who basically doesn't need any help from anybody in the snake department, you know, as far as how to manage his collection, the fact that he entrusts you with that says a lot about who you are, you know? I mean, he's putting a lot of faith in you to make sure that, you know, these AMLs go with these AMLs and these, you know, all these other things happening in the right way. And I'm sure you're in charge of making sure that nothing cross contaminates and that everybody knows who the daddy is on every clutch that's coming out of there, right?
Yeah, no, his system has definitely stuck with me into other aspects of my life and the way I manage animals and the way I think about things, so.
That's great. Well, you're very fortunate to have the opportunity to work for Eugene. You live close by him?
Yeah. So when I was moving out to college, I basically had the option of living in a dorm and selling all the snakes or trying to buy property and get some land. So I'm actually out 5 acres, probably half a mile down the road from him. So I'm, you know, on land, have outbuildings and a nice setup to do snakes without the animals. Ticking off his neighbors and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a perfect setup, man. And it sounds like, I'm sure with your ecology background, that you're making that work out really good, too. I can imagine you working the land, doing the right thing.
Exactly.
Now, now, all right, so, like, give us just, like, how does one get to Togo? What do you got to do?
All right, so my trip to Togo was, you know, I really can't take credit for a whole lot of it, basically because I had a friend who had already planned out all the infrastructure, and he was doing a conservation project for a completely unrelated thing, like not even related to reptiles. And so I basically sort of invited myself along and just said, you know, if there's any sort of grunt I need someone to do, I'd be happy to go and earn my keep and that kind of thing. So, and then while we were there, how can you be in Togo and not check out the ball pythons and go herping and stuff like that? So, yeah, getting there though is definitely quite the undertaking, and I don't even know if it would be possible without knowing someone on the ground. But what we did was we flew into Ghana because Ghana has a much bigger airport, so the flights are like way cheaper. But to get into Ghana, you need a Ghana visa. Then we had to cross into Togo, which was probably the most difficult part of the trip because basically what they want to do is at the Togo border, you have to get, you know, a bunch of paperwork and apply for a visa there. And then they want to inspect all your luggage, which basically means in the middle of the street, because the passport office is basically a shack, they want to unpack all of your bags, put all your stuff on the ground and examine it to make sure you don't have any contraband kind of stuff. But, you know, there's hundreds of people walking across the given time, so you know, you don't want all of your stuff on. This is a scenario where.
Oh, no, we're having technical difficulties with your phone, man. Find a better location because you're fading in and out. Steve? Uh-oh, you dropped off. All right, this hasn't happened in a while. Let's see how CK handles this without losing his cookies. We're doing all right. What we're going to do is wait for Steve to call back. I think I see him right there. Hold on a second, guys. Hey, Steve.
Hey, sorry about that.
Hey, you were talking about contraband and people like stepping all over it.
Oh, yeah. So, they want to throw all your luggage out in the street, make sure you don't have anything you're not supposed to have, which is something you definitely don't want to have happen. And I'm not sure if it's actually protocol or just kind of a way to get you extra money. But if you kind of grease the palms a little bit, that sort of speeds along that process.
Sure.
The most intimidating part of the trip because, you know, people speaking a different language with, you know, machine guns, and they want to look for stuff, and you know, you don't really know what's going on, and there's no one really telling you what's going on. So it's very confusing and very difficult. But
oh man, dude, you're in a really bad location, or your cell signal is just dropping off for some other reason. So I don't want to lose you again, but if I do, just call right back. But
yeah,
we can't hardly hear you.
Sorry, is this any better?
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Yeah. So, that was probably the most intimidating part of the trip. But Togo itself was—I liked it a lot better than I liked Ghana. The people there seem to be a bit more friendly. The society itself is more of like an agriculture-based society, whereas Ghana seems to be more of like a hunting-based society. So the people in Togo are kind of a lot more laid back.
Okay.
So I definitely felt pretty safe in Togo itself. But then just being able to fly to the country, you know, you have to get a bunch of different vaccinations and stuff like that. And it's, you know, you're kind of worried about Ebola. You know, you have to go through Ebola screenings at all the airports and border crossings and stuff. So it's, you know, my biggest concern was getting sick and running into unsavory people, and neither of those two things happened. So.
Well, that's cool. So, I mean, the trip itself is, you know, it's probably, I would probably imagine it's about an 8 or 10 hour trip by flight from Miami.
We flew through New York, and from New York to Accra in Ghana was like close to 11 hours, I think.
Okay. All right. I guess there's no direct flights from Miami then.
No, it was a long, long process. I mean, we were in transit like for 20 something hours, 22 hours, I think, from the time we took off, from the time I took off in Orlando to the time I landed in Accra was like 22 hours.
Ugh. Yeah, I've had those marathon trips. They suck. But, you know, and the good thing is you get off the tarmac, and there's no airport, right? You just get off on the tarmac?
No, I mean, you do get off on the tarmac, and they kind of bus you into this terminal thing. But I have to admit, I mean, Accra and Ghana, there's a fair amount of trade and a fair amount of money going into Ghana. So it was relatively developed. I mean, there are nice hotels in Ghana. There's, there's definitely infrastructure there. It wasn't as kind of sketchy as I thought it would be. Now, Togo's a little bit different. Togo doesn't have that same kind of money coming into the economy from you know, foreign places. But flying into Ghana is very, I would say, very safe and very doable.
Huh. That sounds good. That sounds like you should do a commercial for the Ghana Board of Tourism. All right,
yeah,
man. So that's
cool.
It's
not easy, but it is doable.
That sounds great. So now you're all right. So now you crossed the border. You had your stuff all over the street. You're in Togo. What happens next?
So we went to, because of the conservation project that we're involved in, we went to a part of Togo, which is the Volta Mountain region, which really is not an area where there's a lot of, you know, kind of wildlife trade, but it's mostly just kind of small family farm kind of things and a couple of cities. But so we hung out in Palame, which is, you know, towards, it's basically at the foot of all these mountains in this little tiny mountain range. So it's sort of an area with a lot of diverse habitat from savanna all the way up to tropical jungle. And you know, at the top of the mountain, it gets, I wouldn't say chilly at all, but, you know, a little bit cooler of a climate.
Okay. So, now, you're, I mean, in all these diverse basically little ecosystems all over the place. I mean, it sounds like they're all close enough to walk in a day, right? You can go from one to the next in no time at all. Like,
yeah.
Did you do a lot of herping while you were there?
Yes, no, we did a lot of herping. It was basically, I think we, it was about a 10 to 15 kilometer hike. We hiked from the house we had rented out all the way up to basically the top of one of these mountains to go herping, and then we had about enough of that, so the next few nights we hired someone to drive us there on a motorbike, and then we'd walk down ourselves. So, yeah, we did a lot of herping there. We saw a lot of really cool stuff. Now, that area, because it is sort of a unique area, has a lot of really endemic species, so we saw a lot of stuff that you wouldn't otherwise see. One of the coolest things we saw was the Togo slippery frog, which is, they were thought to be extinct in Togo, and there's, I think, only one known population in Ghana, and that population is collapsing. And so we found a little population, that a very healthy population in Togo, which, you know, could, I mean, this frog is critically endangered, thought to be, you know, about to become extinct, and we found a decent little population that really, you know, says a lot towards the importance of this particular region.
That's cool, man. Now, you know, unfortunately, you know as well as I do, if you could have brought back 24 slippery frogs, by all means, there'd be slippery frogs on the U.S. market and all over the world in no time.
Yeah, but, I mean, the person I was with did manage to bring some of them back, and they went to some zoo conservation breeding something. I mean, that's, you know, when you have a species that delicate, you know, you really want to get it established in captive populations, especially in, like, zoos and stuff like that. So, you know, we were able to help secure that population for sure.
Oh, that's cool. So you did some nice fringe work too while you were there. Besides, I mean, I'm happy to hear that, and I'm happy to hear there's people with a conservation brain. I mean, and I realize you're on the fence between the hunters and the hippies, according to you. But like the conservation brains, they're so focused on the in situ populations, which is great, and that's where the focus should be ultimately. But in the meantime, until you can safeguard the in situ populations, which to me, I honestly, there's very few places where you can seriously safeguard an in situ population, because a lot of these critically endangered populations are in really critically endangered habitats too.
Oh yeah, so, no, absolutely. This particular population, we basically found in a waterfall that had been stripped of vegetation because it was sort of like set up like a tourist attraction, even though there really aren't any tourists. So they're trying to charge people to come in there and bathe in the waterfall, and meanwhile they're destroying the habitat of this basically extinct frog. So, but yeah, and then we saw a lot of other cool stuff too, stiletto snakes, a ton of geckos, tortoises, turtles. I'm really into fish, so we saw some really cool cichlids. It was a little bit of everything.
What kind of cichlids did you see? I mean, obviously Well, those aren't the Great African Lakes aren't over there, right?
They weren't particularly pretty. They're just not something you'd commonly find in the fish trade.
In the rift. Yeah, they're not. I mean, but these aren't Rift Lake populations that happen to be.
No, nothing like that.
Okay, so it's something we've probably never seen. You couldn't get pictures, huh?
No, I have some pictures of them somewhere floating around. I haven't. I've been stretched so thin, I haven't had time to really sit down and put all my pictures together. And I took hours and hours of video there. I have some videos of some really cool stuff. So, but yeah, I mean, and then at the exporters, you would see everything from, you know, mambas to gaboon vipers to sand boas to, you know, you name it. If they think they can make a dollar off it, chances are they're gonna try. So,
yeah. That sounds great, though. You know what? Believe it or not, I mean, I'm pretty sure you know this because you sound like the same person I am. I mean, you had fish before you had herps, probably, because it was cool. You know, it was all right with your parents to do that. You know, at least that's what it was for my generation. Things are a little different now where kids can, you know, they basically can talk their parents into almost anything because it's more accepted, you know. It's like
yeah.
It's a little more mainstream than it used to be. But, you know, the big thing was, you know, I always wanted a python, but my parents always said, well, you could get some fish. So you go about it that way, you know, until you get older and you can do your own thing. But the there's a huge population of ichthyophans on the BLBC board. So if you ever, you know, put in the off-topic section, post up those cichlids, man, people would totally be into seeing that stuff. So
Yeah. And also with the frogs, we saw some really cool fish. There's like this little mini ecosystem where these critically endangered frogs are living and reproducing, and the only other things there are like crabs that probably eat the frogs, and then you have these little loaches. So you have these like three species are the only thing found in this waterfall, and they have like this weird little dynamic worked out, which it's really kind of a cool little ecosystem. But.
Oh man, that is really cool, and to be able to experience something like that, that's like a, you know, it's. I mean, if you're into nature, like you know, most of the fans of the show are. I mean, that must have been just unbelievable experience. You could have spent a week sitting in that little waterfall.
Oh yeah, and the significance of it as a whole was lost to me at the time because I didn't realize how rare this frog was. But I mean, this frog is. They don't exist in Togo, and here they are, you know. So it was a really cool experience. So
that is totally awesome, man. Now, all right, so you got to see some awesome endangered stuff. You got to see a ton of other herps, geckos, tortoises, all kinds of stuff like that. Did you see any cool venomous stuff in the wild or just at the trade markets?
So the stiletto snake, we found a couple of those, and that was so cool to me because I remember seeing a documentary on stiletto snakes like ages ago when I was, you know, a kid, and they stuck in my head as one of the weirdest and coolest species of venomous snake. And so we found some of those, which, you know, I don't know how familiar you are with them, but they're one of the few venomous snakes where you cannot grab them behind the head or you will absolutely get bit because they have this fang that instead of flicking down, it flicks sideways out of their mouth. So if you grab them behind the head, they can absolutely 100% flip that fang back and get you. So it's really cool. I got a lot of pictures of the fang sticking out and this snake trying to, you know, jab the hook. And they're such a unique snake and a unique adaptation. And when you go into how their fangs evolved, it's sort of like a separate evolutionary process from any other venomous snake, which is really cool. And so that was so cool to see one of those guys. And they're kind of hard. I mean, they're not hard to identify, but we weren't expecting to see one in the habitat that we saw them in, so we almost just grabbed them, and then at the last minute, I was like, let's use the snake talk for this, and sure enough, we grab the snake, and that thing comes out, and we're like, well, there goes a trip to the hospital, so.
Oh, jeez, yeah, can you imagine how long that would have taken to get to a hospital from there?
Now, yeah, I don't even know if they exist.
Yeah, I'm saying you're just going to, you know, tell your friends to tell your friends back home that you love them, and that's it at that point. But you got pictures of that, you said?
Yeah, I'll have to post them out. They're a really unique snake, and I got some really good photos of them.
That's great. You definitely have to post that stuff up on the boards because, you know, I mean, look, a lot of people on our boards are into the stuff that's available in captivity, but it's the fringe stuff that we can't keep or it's just too crazy to keep or you can't get that, you know, people are also interested in that. So by all means, man, if you could post some pics up, you know, everybody listening to this show is going to head over to the boards and look for that stuff. So that's really good, man. Now, all right, so you got to live this secret dream that everybody has, and that's going into a – going into a termite mound and looking for BPs, and you definitely got to recount some of that for us.
Yeah, so it's actually not that hard to find ball pythons there, but the problem is we were there in the wrong season. So this year, you know, the weather is more or less temperature-wise constant year-round. What really changes is the rain, and so in the dry season, it's really easy to walk the fields and see these burrows where basically every burrow, not every burrow, but you know, if you know how to read the burrows, you'll have no problem finding ball pythons in them. We were there in the wet season, and in the wet season, all this undergrowth comes up. So it's really hard to actually find the burrows because they're covered in grass. So we had a lot of trouble finding ball python, but when we went out with a couple of people, they showed us really where to look. And so in the termite mounds, you can definitely find ball pythons, which, you know, I didn't realize how difficult that would be because, you know, that the termite mound is, it's not quite as hard as concrete, but it's very dense stuff. And when you're trying to dig through it, you upset these termites. And so I didn't think of anything of it. I was like, oh, they're little termites. But then these big worker or army termites come out with these massive heads. And those things hurt. They grab a hold of you, and it is not a pleasant experience. So you're kind of like doing this little ant stance while you're trying to dig into this burrow and, you know, hoping there's not a cobra in it while you stick your head inside to see if there's anything in there. So it's not easy. It definitely would be a lot easier in the dry season. But, yeah, it was a unique experience.
Well, you know what I would recommend is a GoPro on a selfie stick before you stick your head in anything. I mean, send a little camera with a flashlight in there first, bro. See what's lurking,
yeah,
you know?
We tried that, but the problem is there's like roots in there too, and there's tucked under stuff. It's one of those things that sounded so easy on paper, and then when I went and did it, I was like, this is not worth it at all. This is way hard.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The reality is, I mean, you were there. I mean, I don't know if you got to talk to the people about the commerce that surrounds this, but I mean, how much money do they make for bringing one back to the trade booth, you know?
So in the area that we were in, the ball python trade really is not, it doesn't exist here. And the reason that is, it's sort of funny. One of the things that I gained from this experience is that how much like one or two people can really make a difference as far as developing a trade like this. Like the information does not really freely flow there. So, you know, if you have one or two people that realize, hey, I can make money digging up ball python nests and getting eggs, you know, that can have a big impact on how they view even the entire species in that area. So we were where we were, when they find a ball python, they eat the ball python. It's their food to them. But in other areas of Togo and Ghana, they view them as, you know, sort of like a way to make income. So when they find a clutch of eggs, or several clutches of eggs, usually they have one spot in the village where, you know, if they find eggs, they'll come and bring them and basically throw them under like a plywood sheet and hatch them out and sell the babies. But if they're making, you know, 50 cents or a dollar for each baby that they're bringing in, if they're bringing in 100 babies, I mean, that represents significant income in a village where the annual income might be, you know, $500 for a person. I think the average income for the entire country is well under $1,000. So, you know, with a lot of the really poor people out in the villages making $500 a year, finding $100 worth of ball pythons in a season, that is incredible for them. That has a huge impact, and it definitely affects the way they view ball pythons as a whole. That way, instead of seeing adult ball pythons and thinking, oh, food, they see adult ball pythons and think, oh, this is going to give me eggs in 6 months. So it definitely provides more incentive to keep ball pythons alive. Not that the population in either area is struggling. They definitely seem to be really common. But it definitely affects the way people view wildlife or ball pythons and perhaps wildlife as a whole, but definitely how they view ball pythons.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, you know, look, in places like that, you know, and I mean, meaning like kind of third world kind of places, you know, life is cheap, and it's really nice that they found a way, unintentionally almost, to propagate sustainable use for a species, you know. And I'm sure you got a couple of feelings on that, being an ecology person. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. So when you look at the ball python trade versus trading other animals in Togo and Ghana, it definitely has a lot more positive outcome for the animals. One of our side trips that we went on, we went to this, they call it a fetish market, but it's, you know, we might call it like voodoo kind of thing, where it's basically uncontrolled sale of basically any animal they can find. And the reason is the cops won't really bust them because they're kind of, you know, it's a voodoo market. They don't want to get cursed. They, you know, the belief in that kind of stuff is really, really high. So we went there and we saw elephant trunks. We saw feet of gorilla. We saw hippo fat, tons of crocodiles, tons of snakes of all types, dead, dried up, tons of bird feathers, a lot of dogs, and just like literally anything they could find, they'll take because they know they can make money off it unsustained. With the ball pythons, the way we have the captive hatch or ranch set up, it provides a lot more incentive to keep them alive, and it kind of affects the way they view those animals to some extent. I mean, they still, you know, they don't view animals the same way we would view animals. Animals to them, it's sort of like how we would view a tree. You know, it's technically alive, but we don't really think of it as alive. So the animal care is definitely lacking over there. But to have a setup where there is at least the possibility of sustained use, like with the ball pythons, it provides a lot more happier of an outcome to both the people there and definitely the animals themselves. So I would say the ball python, the farmed ball pythons are definitely a success story as far as conservation is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds that way, and you would wonder why more species don't get thrown into something like that, where it's, I mean, look, everybody wants fancy birds and fancy critters and all sorts of other species of things, and not everybody, obviously, but us exotic freaks, you know, that like
yeah.
cool stuff
well,
like
I think,
that.
I think it comes down to ball pythons got lucky because they can survive the whole process. I mean, if there was, you know, where I saw people keeping ball pythons in bags for months with no food and water, you know, that they because they don't really think of animals as alive, they don't really think of animal care as a thing. There's really not very many people who know how to keep anything alive in Africa for any extended period of time. So,
sure. You
know, that ball pythons just got lucky because they happened to be able to survive those conditions. If you had anything even remotely more fragile, it just, you know, they wouldn't be sellable. They would be dead before they could ever be sold. So, you know, I think that really is what it comes down to. If you had someone who knew how to keep stuff alive over there, I'm sure they could do really well and create a lot of good sustainable type programs. But if they try to keep anything else alive, it eventually ends up dying, usually before they can sell it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because they never really keep things alive, they eat them fresh, you know, and
yeah, exactly.
freshly caught, you know.
It's basically, you know, they'll a lot of times they'll catch stuff and they'll keep it alive until it dies, and then once it dies, they'll just eat it. You know, it's like I can either sell it while it's alive, or wait for it to die, and then eat it then. But they kind of like to keep their options open. You know, like one of the examples, I was offered an albino ball python that someone had found out in the bush, and they wanted like $500 for it, and I tried to explain to them that just wasn't possible. So I offered them, you know, cash money and decent cash money, even above market price here in the U.S., and they're like, no, I would rather, you know, take my chances and wait another week or two and see if anyone else wants to buy it. And it's like, in a week or two, this thing will be dead. And that's what ended up happening. It ended up dying. And, you know, I just, if it was me, I would take the money while it was still alive versus, you know, taking that gamble. But, you know, it's just animals aren't alive to them. And it's just a slightly different mindset. So it's, it definitely affects the way the animal trade occurs there, both positively and negatively. So,
yeah. And, you know, but you wonder how the sentiment pervades in a place like Indonesia, where they do have, you know, better care setups because they know they're going to be exporting these animals, and these animals got to get to the other side alive, and they are caring for them a little bit, you know, before they're sent out, and why that mentality can't be introduced, you know, it's very, I guess you're going against their social system to do it, and probably makes it difficult.
Yeah,
but
no, conservation in Africa presents a lot of problems, and I don't mean to overgeneralize. I mean, we did see a lot of people who did have some knowledge on stuff, and they were definitely open to listening to advice. They just, you know, if you don't have anyone to teach you this, and no one in the country would have that background knowledge, I mean, where, how are you supposed to figure this stuff out? But we did see a few people that knew how to keep stuff alive, like the one woman I posted a photo of. She kept stuff alive. Her stuff was very healthy. So, you know, it definitely can be done there. It's just not, you know, you would have to kind of change the way they view animals before you can kind of change the way they take care of them to some extent. But, you know, they are, you know, there's nothing malicious about it. If there's a better way, they're not going to, you know, they wouldn't throw money away just like we wouldn't. So if you say, hey, you can keep 10 times more scorpions alive if you give them water, you know, they're up to listening to stuff like that. So,
yeah. Well, that's good, man. So now, you did a little shopping while you were there. So now, what animals did you bring back? And how cool was it to be able to pick out your own bull pythons over there?
It was very interesting. Not exactly what I thought it would be. I will admit that they, you know, they have internet over there. They know exactly what they're supposed to be looking for. So when we were picking out stuff, most of it had already been picked through. And so I've spent, like, you know, close to an hour picking through normals, and then the lady comes up and she's like, what are you looking for? And I was like, anything different. She's like, oh, we already have a bucket set aside for those. So she brings me this bucket, and there's, you know, she's like, yeah, there's yellow bellies in there, there's cinnamons in there. You know, she knew the names of exactly what stuff was, and she had them all sorted by what they were. So they know exactly what they're looking for over there to some extent. I mean, some of the dark morphs I think might be a little bit lost. But, you know, I think if you're buying imports from Africa with the expectation of seeing yellow bellies and cinnamons and stuff hiding in there, these days it won't happen. They've already long been picked through. They know exactly what they're looking for. So it was sort of interesting because most of my work had already been done for me. I just sort of got to pick through the ones that had already been picked through. And there, I saw a lot of cool stuff in there, you know, some desert ghost-looking things, orange dream-looking things, you know, a lot of different oddball stuff. And so I brought a lot of those babies back just because, I mean, how could you not go there and pick through
sure.
import ball pythons? So that was a very unique experience. And then the other animals I brought back, I did bring back one giant ball python. She measures she measured like 6 foot, 1/2 inch, maybe 6 foot and an inch. She wasn't really stretched out, but just a massive ball python, one of the biggest I've seen. And the head on it, just out of this world. It looks like, you know, a retic head. It's just huge. So that female I fell in love with, and I had to bring her back. She's doing really well. And I did pick out one pair of locality ball pythons that we found, you know, just normal ball pythons. But it sort of interested me that, you know, a locality ball python doesn't really exist out there. So I really doubt it'd ever be a project anyone would be super interested in. But, you know, it's still kind of cool to have GPS coordinates on this pair of ball pythons to know exactly where they were found and, you know, to kind of be able to propagate that a little bit. I don't know if there'd be a huge demand for it, but there might be someone out there who think that'd be cool. So,
yeah. No, that's not, I mean, look, it's cool because if you do have coordinates on it, I mean, you have the only ones in the world.
Yeah.
Because nobody else does.
Exactly. Well, cornered the market on those, so.
Yeah.
But,
the
other thing I brought back, like 15 West African sand boas. And you know, it's sort of been a pet project for me because way back when I was like 13 or 14 years old, I tried to buy a pair of Kenyan sand boas as the first snakes I was ever going to try to breed. And so they were like my second and third snake. And someone sold me a pair of West African sand boas that had been imported as a pair of captive bred Kenyan sand boas that kind of ripped me off a little bit. And so I freaked out when I found out that they were a different species. I couldn't get them to do anything for me, and I panicked, and I kind of gave them away. So, you know, that was nearly a decade ago, and so, you know, now I'm like, I wanted to get a bunch of sand boas, get them established, get a captive breeding group going, sort of as kind of like a coming full circle kind of thing for me a little bit, you know, just as something that has been sort of, I feel like I didn't do the project justice when I tried 8 or 10 years ago, so, you know, I sort of wanted to kind of prove that you know, kind of prove that the guy couldn't rip me off a little bit, you know, that I would still end up ahead kind of thing. I don't know. It's sort of just a little, I think they're really cool. And so I've wanted to.
Those are the Muellerites, right?
As a project. Yeah.
But I mean, they look so much like Kenyans. It's not like, I bet the guy who sold them to you probably didn't rip you off on purpose, you know?
No, he knew. I sent him an email and his response was basically like, oh, that sucks. He's not a sketchy guy, but that was a long time ago. He's no longer in the business, but
see, you outlasted him, man. Good job.
Yeah. But yeah,
dude,
they are,
believe
really
it or not,
cool species,
I'm giving you the 2-minute warning. We're getting I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'm giving you the 2-minute warning because we're getting really close. And I don't know, I mean, we can maybe talk a little bit more about this, but I also want to get maybe I want to get you on for a blood python show. You got a lot of stuff in your head about bloods?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so maybe we're going to do that one day. I mean, what was so really quick in a 1-minute synopsis, what was your biggest takeaway from this trip?
My biggest takeaway was definitely how much the market over here affects people over there. I mean, we don't think much of a normal ball python dropping from $8 to, or from $10 to $8 on a wholesale market, but over there, $2 a ball python equates for a lot of people with a lot less income suffering a lot more. So that was my biggest takeaway, is how much over here affects things going on over there.
Yeah, it's an angle we don't probably ever consider, you know?
And I never did, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good spot, man. Steve, it was a pleasure having you on. You were a great guest. We're gonna have to work on that location for your phone call in, so that you don't have that little glitch in your technical abilities to talk.
Yep, no problem.
And we'll do that maybe next time. But I do want to have you back on. Maybe we'll talk about Bloods. We'll talk maybe a little more sustained use. Maybe we'll talk about you strumping around in the glades. See any skunk apes?
Sure. Yeah, no skunk apes.
All right, man. Hey, thank you so much